This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Thane Benson. He's a librarian at the Denver Public Library and the author of Murder Mystery, Graphic Novels, and More, Innovative Programs for Engaging Teens in Your Library. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support or patreon.com/circideas. Thane, welcome to Circulating Ideas.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk mostly today about your book, which is Murder Mystery, Graphic Novels, and More, Innovative Programs for Engaging Teens in Your Library. But I wanted to get started by asking, how did you get started in libraries in the first place? What led you to this as your profession?
Okay, sure. Yeah, it's kind of I took a circuitous path to the library. I'm an artist. That's my background. And I went to, I got my undergrad degree in art, in illustration. And straight out of art school, my first commercial art job was working for a toy company. And I was in the color department, so I was coloring toy models that were then being produced en masse in China. Mm-hmm. And that job did not go so well for a number of reasons. I won't get into all the stories now, but it kind of left me, I wasn't there very long, but it kind of left me very turned off from the commercial art world. Right. And I still love art and I still do art, but finishing that job, I really didn't want art to be my job.
Okay.
And so I started looking around for other jobs. And I thought, well, I want to do something, you know, that helps people, that is actually worthwhile for a job, not just a paycheck. So I started working at different nonprofits and things like that. And I ended up almost by accident, ended up doing like a lot of, construction work with nonprofits that eventually led into, commercial construction is what I ended up doing. And suddenly I found myself, you know, like doing a job that wasn't really helping people. You know, if you do nonprofit construction, you're working with kind of the poor, which is great. If you do commercial construction, you're essentially working with the rich,
right?
Not like, so I had a series of construction jobs that again, just sort of became jobs. But I always liked the library. I was always a fan of the library. It was originally not my intention to work in the library, but I always liked libraries and I always kind of had my eye on the library and I moved around a bit and I applied, moving around, you know, you need a new job when you move to a new town. So I had my eye on the library in Denver because I was a frequent user of the library. It kind of goes back to being an artist, like, looking for inspiration.
Right.
Really, I always enjoyed consuming library materials that way. So I thought it'd be fun to work at the library, and eventually it just worked out that after applying many times, I think I applied 10 times, and then
wow.
I finally got like an entry-level part-time shelving job at the Denver Public Library. It was a four-month position when I got it. But I was excited to work at the library. I liked the library, and so I started working, you know, as a shelver, putting books on shelves. In case that's not obvious what the shelver does. because I'd worked with different nonprofits, I'd done a program called Urban Servant Corps here in Denver, years before. And it's not AmeriCorps, but it's an AmeriCorps affiliated program. So what that means is, I qualified for the AmeriCorps scholarship money. And I had done it. I was a few years older than most kids do it, you know, do AmeriCorps straight out of college. I was a few years older, so I had already paid off all of my undergrad loans. But you could use the scholarship money towards graduate school as well. So I literally started at the library, and it had been 7 years since I'd done that AmeriCorps program, or almost 7 years, and that scholarship money disappears after 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had like a couple months before it was just gone. So I was like, oh, I should use this. So I was like, well, I work in the library now. I should go to library school. So I started working in the library. I immediately started talking to librarians, like, I think I'm going to go to library school. Where do you suggest going? And I was advised to go online. It'd be much cheaper to go online. And more than one person recommended San Jose State University. So I looked them up, and they seemed good. They were on the more affordable side of online schools. So kind of in a quick motion, I applied there, got in, and did my graduate got my MLS. And yeah, and just kind of worked my way up through the library, you know, went from a shelver to a clerk to a part-time librarian to a full-time librarian, which is where I'm at now.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yes, that is a very circuitous route.
And that's the short version I try to keep you.
Yeah, and San Jose does have a good reputation and everything. So, I mean, that you picked a good school, I think. So.
Yeah, I had a great experience there. I was a little nervous. I think when I started my master's, it had been 13 years since I graduated from undergrad. And I was, keep in mind, I was an art student. So I wrote very few papers.
Right.
So I was a little nervous at first, but I caught on after a while. I did my very first paper. I did have like a panic attack writing the paper. Like, I don't know how to do this. And I had to get my wife to like talk me down and be like, just write what they want. But once I finished that first paper, it was pretty smooth sailing.
Great. So what led you to want to work with teens?
Yeah, so when I was talking before about working for nonprofits, I worked at this place called Nazareth Farm in West Virginia, which took high school and college students basically on retreats. They would come out there for a week, and then the staff, the live-in staff that I was part of, would take them out into rural Appalachia and do home repair with them. So I got interested in this program because I wanted to learn carpentry is really what I wanted to do when I started the program or started working, excuse me, for Nazareth Farm. But to my surprise, what I ended up loving the most was working with the high school students and the college students. I just really, really enjoyed working with young people, which was a surprise to me. It's not something I thought I would be particularly good at or enjoy, but that was the case. So, yeah, when I got involved with the library, when I started working for libraries, you know, the libraries I worked at were doing teen advisory boards and that sort of thing and doing teen programming. So I kind of wormed my way in there being like, oh, I'd be interested in doing this. And yeah, even as a clerk, not as a librarian, I ended up running some teen programs. It just kind of worked out. It's, you know, being a library student and working at a library is a nice situation because people let you explore different things and encouraging if you want to try out things.
Right.
So I said I wanted to try out, and I kind of just sat in on the teen group. But then lucky for me, the woman who was running the teen group went on maternity leave, so I ended up taking it over, which ended up being a great experience. And yeah, and just like that was my favorite thing of doing the retreat stuff at Nazareth Farm, working with teens has become my favorite thing at the library.
I know sometimes they can be a tough crowd to appeal to and get them to come into programs at the library. What kind of, I mean, this is going to lead us into the book, I think, but what kind of creative programs do you think you need to do to draw them in and get their attention and make them want to come to the library?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. That's a tricky question. I get asked that a lot because I've had a lot of success with that. And I think what you need to do is, it's hard, but you need to try and figure out what the teens in your area are into, basically.
Right.
If you have a tab, that's great because you can sort of tap into that and see what they want to do. What I've personally had success with is kind of doing unusual creative programming, and kind of that has attracted teens. You know, my book is called Murder Mystery Graphic Novels and More. And running murder mystery programs has been a real boon to me as far as getting kids in the library, getting young people in the library. Mm-hmm. I currently work for a branch here in Denver called the Sam Gary branch. And when I started working at this branch, I took over the tab, the teen advisory board, because I expressed that as a strong interest. And at the time, I think there were like three kids in the tab, but really it was more like two and a half. We only had like half a kid.
Right.
So it was kind of a small program, but I mean, it was nothing. So I did have that advantage of starting with just a few kids, a few teens. And I said, you know what, I want, and this was kind of my idea, but they jumped on board. I was like, I think we should do a murder mystery program. I think we should create our own murder mystery program, you know, write it ourselves, act it out, and then have teens come in and participate, and they'll see the, you know, the quote unquote murder happen, and then they'll have to solve it by looking for clues and by interviewing the suspects that they mm-hmm. have to play. And the teens got behind that and they thought it was a cool idea. So it was fun. So we wrote it together. And we had a great time. But like two kids is not enough to do it with.
Right.
So I had that full in staff. So we had, like one of the Tab kids' older siblings came in to play a character. I had several staff members come in and play characters. I played a character. So so we ended up, you know, with seven actors in our play, who ended up being our seven suspects. Mm-hmm. And then we advertised, and word spread, because it's kind of an interesting thing. Like, oh, cool, a murder mystery is something unusual to do in the library. And so we had a really good draw for that the very first time we did it. And immediately following that, the number of kids who participated in the Tab group skyrocketed after that. We got up to, it was kind of loose, but we had like 12 to 15 kids at one point. And that's then great. I put a hard cap at 10 because it got a little nutty. So our run, I found 10 is kind of the max I feel is efficient. But all those kids that came in afterwards, they all came to that event. They all came to that murder mystery event and were like, this is cool. I want to be part of the group that does this.
Yeah.
So that event ended up being a big like recruiting thing. And we do that every year now. It's like a Halloween tradition. It syncs very nicely with the Halloween season. And we have kind of a steady influx of new interested people coming in as a result of that.
Well, and it seems like an important part of that was that you worked with the teens to create it even. So, I mean, they helped write the mystery and all this kind of stuff, too. So that having them involved in the actual creation of the programs, I think, can be a boon.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We try to do that as much as possible with all our pretty much all our teen programming. I mean, that's kind of the point of the Tab that we run. I mean, that being said, you know, as the person in charge of it, I have to make certain decisions.
Oh, sure.
I have to nick certain ideas or, it's not fun being the adult, but I am the adult in the room. And sometimes I have to do that.
Yeah. And I think it helps with some of the other programs that you've got in there that you're an illustrator. And I should say that you also illustrate the book, including a sequential art section in the graphic novel section, which I thought was very clever. But you bring that talent to some of your programs as well. So that's the thing I think that's important for people is remember what you do really well and try to apply that. And then they'll be able to see that you have this passion for this thing and this talent to do this thing. And that can help, whether it's illustrating or not, it just tap into your own real passions.
Yes, absolutely. And in the, I think it's in the conclusion of the book, I talk about this thing being the Venn diagram of awesome. And that's the sweet spot where it's like your personal passions and interests and talents, where that overlaps with the teens' interests and passions and where it overlaps with, library resources. If you can find that perfect Venn diagram of awesome, as I call it in the book, that's where you want to work from. And that's not a concept I came up with. I think, It's not necessarily a new concept in general, but the term Venn diagram of awesome I learned from a coworker of mine named Nate Stone, who runs our maker spaces here in the Denver Public Library system. And I remember at the meeting I was at where he presented that, and that was just very empowering to me to hear that, to be like, oh, you know, it's not selfish of me to kind of pursue what I'm excited about, what I like doing. Like, it actually makes me a better library employee to kind of share mm-hmm. that enthusiasm.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is broken down basically into four different sections. There's creativity games, graphic novel creation, murder mystery event, which we just talked about, and animation. How much of that, obviously you've done illustration before because that's your background. How much of the other stuff had you done before? How much history did you have using creating these type of things before you had them for the library?
All of them a little bit. I mean, I've always been a big fan of games. I'm a big believer in games and that they build creativity and they also build teamwork doing with people. So I've been a lifelong fan of all sorts of games, any kind of game. The murder mystery thing, actually, years before I ever worked for the library, I used to help out with a nonprofit that a friend of mine started here in Denver that at the time was called the Denver... What was it called? The Metro Denver Ocean of Letters is what it was called. It's since been renamed Denver Writes, which is a little easier to roll off the tongue. But it's loosely based on the, 826 Valencia thing that I'm blanking on the guy's name, the famous author Dave Edgars started.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if you're familiar with that model, it's kind of the same thing. Where it's basically just a nonprofit that encourages literacy among young people and teaches all kinds of, you know, different writing courses and that sort of thing. And I've helped them with some graphic novel type stuff. But what they would do every year for a fundraiser is they would do a murder mystery event that was really fun. That the first year they did it, I just participated. I just went to it, paid a few dollars. I don't remember what it was. But then they set up a whole story, and they set it up on South Broadway, which is kind of right in the heart of Denver. And they had different people set up at different locations in South Broadway who were all suspects in this murder. And basically, you walked up and down the street visiting different locations trying to piece together the story. And it was really fun, and I thought it was a very novel idea for a fundraiser. And then I was telling my friend how much I enjoyed it, and I said, I'd like to get involved in it. And she said, oh, they're always looking for writers. And, I write and draw, doing comic book stuff and other stuff, so I was excited to get involved with them. So I kind of joined up with this small group that was running it. There was like three or four of us. But they basically taught me kind of the formula for how to build a murder mystery and how to divide it up under suspects and make it into a game. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward formula. It's covered in the book. But that's how I got started with murder mysteries. So when we started doing it at the library, I was like, oh, this is actually something I have experience in,
right,
making
right.
murder mysteries. Who knew it would be professionally helpful in the library? And then animation, which is another section of the book, is something I've kind of always messed around with, something I've always thought was fun, going back to my art school days and just mm-hmm. kind of with my own personal art. And kind of what I try and stress in the animation section is there is some digital stuff, like I cover how to make animated GIFs and stuff like that. But animation, predates computers, it predates film. Like there's very simple animation you can do with just paper, which I think is really fun and accessible. And I like exposing people to that because they don't always realize like how old animation is.
Right. And it doesn't always click with people that those flip books you had when you were a kid, that's animation, but it's in the corner where you're just flipping by. Yeah. And in the creativity game section, that's kind of a lot of that is what sometimes people use as icebreaker kind of things. And just fun things to help you get to know each other and, do some teamwork exercises. Are there any in there in particular that are your favorites?
It's hard to pick a favorite, but maybe the storytelling game is my absolute favorite. And I also like it because you can only really do it once. I'll just explain real quick how it works.
Yeah.
You have a whole group of people, and you have half of them basically leave the room for a good amount of time, 15, 20 minutes, and you tell them the group inside is going to come up with a story, and then they have to come back and figure out what the story is. So they leave, and then once they leave, you inform the other group that this is really a trick, that we're not going to come up with a story, that they're going to come back, and when the idea is they're supposed to guess what happened in the story, and mm-hmm. whatever they say, if it ends with a vowel, you say, yes, that happened, and if it ends with a consonant, the last word, you say, no, it didn't happen. So they come back, and they say, is this, they say whatever they want to say, but is this like a science fiction story? And if it ends with a Y, story of the Y, you say, well, sort of, that's kind of the in between. So they'll come back, and they'll say, is this a science fiction story? We'll say, sort of, and they say, does it take place in space? Space ends in an E, so we say, yes. They say, does it take place on a spaceship? Ship ends in a P, so we'd say no. So basically, they end up building the story. And what I think is so fun about that game is the people participating who are asking the questions don't realize that they're actually telling the story.
Right.
It's like a trick. It's like tricking people into being creative and tricking them into telling their own crazy story. And they come up with some pretty wild, inventive stuff. Like, it's pretty fun. I've done this game before using just like one person leaves the room and then they come back and tell the story, but I found it works better with the group where they have a few people asking the questions. And that game tickles me to no end. And the first time I played it, I was the victim. I did not know. I was telling the story. Some friends of mine. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like you said, you can't really play it twice with the same group of people though. So.
Right. No.
Once you know the trick.
That's beautiful. I do have a current group of kids that I've done it with, and we decided not to tell them the trick at the end. So we've done it a few times, and they still think we're making up the story, which I don't know. Maybe it's cruel, but it's also sort of fun.
Yeah, I like the drawing one, the exquisite corpse one. I like that. That's a fun one, I think. So.
Oh yeah, that one's great. Do you mean the one where it's just drawing, or the one where you go back and forth with the?
Where you go back and forth, yeah. So you kind of create this surreal thing.
Yeah, that game I think is super fun too. We do that one a lot. The library I used to work at, I showed them that one time, and then we didn't really have a good name for it. We just called it kind of the drawing game, but then they renamed it everyone's favorite game because that's just what they wanted to do every time we met. I've played that game a lot of times, and I've never, ever played it where there hasn't been at least one person's thing that ended up absolutely hysterical.
Another section you have in there is the graphic novel creation. And like I said, you do that as a graphic novel, which is very clever, I think. Do you find that that's a popular one around with your group of teens?
Yeah, that one's been kind of a steady success for us over the past several years. That one I started doing early, kind of in my library career, and it's funny because originally it wasn't my idea. Like another staff member was like, "Oh, why don't you know we do book clubs and stuff like that?" And they're like, "Why don't we do a graphic novel workshop?" And I was like, "I would love to do that." And again, it was I think I was a little hesitant to do it because I was like, "Well, I want to do this. Does everyone else want to do this?"
Right.
But once another staff person mentioned it, I was like, "Okay, let's go for it. Let's see what happens." And again, this is kind of early on in teen stuff. In my experience doing teen stuff, teen programs where we haven't always had a whole lot of success. So I was not expecting a ton of teens to show up. You know, if we got six kids, I would have been happy. But the first year we did it, we had 20 something students show up to do it, which really surprised me. I didn't know there was a big enough draw for that. But I think that's just kind of where we're at culturally with comic books and graphic novels, where there's a lot of interest, especially among young people.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, that was kind of a big success. We had a lot of students turn out, which was great, and we produced a lot of stuff. And it's been fun because we collect it and we publish it in a comic book every year. And it's been fun now. I think we have we're up to volume 4 or 5 at this point, but it's fun to kind of have that collection sitting on our library shelf of all mm-hmm. the students' work.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you have any recommendations for people who want to do that kind of program but don't have the skill themselves, you know, to act? They can't draw or they can't write necessarily. Would you recommend that they do that kind of program too? And if so, do you have any recommendations for how they can go about that?
Yes, I would absolutely recommend anyone doing it. The only caveat is I recommend you doing it if you enjoy comic books and graphic novels,
right,
that you
right.
like, then I would do it. You certainly don't need to draw to be able to do it. You certainly don't need to be able to write to do it. You know, the books we produce, I don't write or draw any of it. It's all the students' work. So even though I have that background, that's not really what I'm contributing. I mean, I do go around and kind of give advice and stuff like that.
Right.
But
right.
I actually don't. When I do the workshops, I usually do 4 different workshops. We do it over 4 weeks. We meet on the same day every week for a couple hours. And I have the students draw right in the workshop. Some of them are motivated and they go home and do extra work at home. But I tell them that's not necessary. Like, we're going to draw right here in the library, and that's what we're going to collect. And I give a little spiel about kind of the language of comic books and graphic novels, kind of very basic stuff on the first day. But my preference is not to be the one presenting through the whole thing. So again, they're drawing while they're in the workshop, but I like to have something playing. So I actually just play videos off YouTube, and I let kind of the professionals do the talking. There's a pretty great How to Draw the Marvel Way that you can find on YouTube that's mm-hmm. Stan Lee and John Buscema going over comic book techniques. And it's a little dated as far as what they do, as far as the materials they use.
Right.
And it does very much skew towards kind of traditional superhero comics, but the fundamentals of storytelling are all in there. And it's fun. And it's fun to see a young Stan Lee who's only in his 60s jumping around doing his shtick. and there's lots of stuff like that you can find on the internet. That's great. The Will Eisner documentary is very good about Will Eisner, who mainstream people don't, he's not really part of the mainstream culture, but if you're into comic books at all, he's like a giant in the comic book world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the documentary they made on him is very good. There's a great documentary called Stripped that's about newspaper comics.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. I can't recommend that one enough. I show that one every year.
Is that that's the Dave Kellett one?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I can't think of the guy's name who did it.
Okay.
It's the one that's famous because they got Bill Watterson to at least record some audio on it, which was,
oh, yeah.
Was a big deal that he agreed to have his voice, even though you don't see his face, you do hear his voice. And Bill Watterson did the cover.
Yeah, and I don't think you can force them all to read Scott McCloud books, but I don't know if there's any YouTube stuff of him talking about his stuff either. But
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of YouTube of Scott McCloud doing panels and stuff. I've seen a lot of those.
Okay.
I do recommend the Scott McCloud book for people who are really interested in comics. I think it's a good exploration of everything comics and graphic novels can do. But I certainly don't do any sort of required reading sort of thing when we do the workshop.
Do you just do traditional draw? Do you have any like digital tools that they can use, like a what are those called, Wacom tablets, or is it all pencil ink?
Yes. So I've gone back and forth. I've done it. I think we started with just like pens and pencils and paper, and then at one point we had them doing stuff with the Wacom tablets. But I've actually gone back to paper and pens just because it's more accessible. I think digital stuff is great. I personally, for my art, I use a lot of digital techniques for my art, but there is something really charming and lovely about the accessibility of just like a piece of paper and a pen, and that like anyone can do that. And again, for students who want to like go home and do extra work at home, it's nice to give them that ability. I do try and push digital lettering just because I found handwriting is not always legible in the comics my students make. So I do try as hard as I can to get them to do lettering digitally, just to make the comics readable and legible.
So when they do that, do they just do it and then they print it out and put it on the page? Or do you scan the pages?
Yeah, I've had them do it a couple different ways. I've had kids just type out their stuff and literally cut and paste onto their comic. At times when we've done more digital stuff, we have had them like scan the artwork in and then layer the text on top using different programs. But again, I kind of like the charm of the cut and paste part, just because the physicality of it
right.
and the simplicity of it.
Yeah. And then how do you manage the animations programs that you do? What kind of programs do you use when you're doing digital, and how do you kind of start out with that kind of program?
Yes, so even when we do the digital stuff, we usually start with some sort of analog version just to kind of get the basic concepts of animation. So, you know, a flipbook is something everybody knows. The, of course, I'm blanking on the name, the thing you spin, what is it called? It used to be called the Wheel of the Devil, but then they renamed it so it would sell. the Zoetrope, is that what it's called? I think it's called a Zoetrope.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Things like that are fun, where you have like a strip of paper and you have different sequences on the paper and you spin the zoetrope. I'm not describing it well, but if you look up zoetrope, you'll know what I'm talking about. So I like to start with the physical paper stuff just to kind of get down the basics, like we're creating an illusion but using separate images to make it look like it's a moving sequence, but they're really separate images. For animation, you know, I like doing animated GIFs is fun because everyone's familiar with those and they're pretty easy to make. And it's the same idea. It's just like a sequence of still images that we're going to rotate between to make it look like something's moving.
Yeah, I was going to say the teens are probably used to that being online and stuff. Those are all over the place on social media. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you can do like stop motion, super fun, and you can do that lots of different ways. There's a bazillion different apps that'll let you do to make it pretty easy to do stop motion with any sort of phone or anything like that. But again, kind of starting with the idea that we're creating nothing actually moves in animation. It's all an illusion.
Right.
And kind of starting with still images and explaining how you do that, I think is once that clicks in kids' heads, they can kind of go where they want with it.
That's really cool. I'm glad they like that kind of thing. I have never done a program like that, but I that's really cool. I'm a manager, so I get to tell my staff which kind of programs to do. So I may ask my teen person to do some of this kind of stuff. That's really cool. So you got all these great ideas, and they work really well with your teens. What gave you the idea that you wanted to put it together into a book?
Yeah. For a few years, I was going around, because things went well, I was encouraged to kind of like share how I did things. And so I would go to different, library conventions, that sort of thing, kind of present on different things. And I was at I live here in Denver, and I was at the, what is it called? The Cal, Colorado Association of Libraries has like, has like their yearly big conference, you know, that, that draws people in statewide. And I was presenting there one year, specifically on doing graphic novels and kind of just going step by step how to do a graphic novel program. And at the convention, there's also, you know, kind of the vendor room where people are trying to sell their different things. And one of the vendors there was ABC Clio, a publisher of instructional texts specifically for library professionals. And they saw my presentation, an editor from them saw my presentation and said, oh, this could be a book. We should do a book of this. And I said, awesome, let's do a book. So basically I kind of worked with them to put together a proposal, and it went through different versions. At first it was just going to be about graphic novels. That was going to be the entire book. Through the revision process, it ended up getting, you know, broader and became all about just creative programming with teens. But that's basically how that happened. I was approached by a publisher, and we did it.
Yeah, you had already been sharing it at the conferences and stuff. So I think that's it's and now in the book you're sharing. It's really important, I think, that we share our ideas about this kind of thing, because we all can get inspired. And reading your book, they might be inspired to do some other kind of program, but they thought about it from reading your book. So I think librarians are pretty good at that, I think, about sharing. But I think that's what that's all about. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been, for me, it's been a whole lot of fun presenting at different places. I strongly encourage people to. I know not everyone's super comfortable standing up in front of a room of people and kind of doing their thing, but it's pretty great, because like if you do it, like attending conferences is fun, but if you present at a conference, then like lots of people come up to you afterwards and like want to talk to you and want to tell you about, you know, what they're doing. So, you know, in my experience, like being a presenter makes attending conferences like a million times.
Yeah, I agree. I've gone to conferences both speaking and not speaking, and it is a different experience when you're speaking. So I wanted to wrap up with giving you kind of an opportunity to talk about the graphic novel stuff that you do. Can you talk about the strips you've done and what you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So people who are interested in my work can find it on my website. It's just my name, ThaneBenson.com, ThaneBenson.com is kind of where you can find all my stuff that's going on. But yeah, again, I come from an art background. I write and draw my own and self-publish my own comic books. The first big book project I did was a book called Burnt, and it's basically a murder mystery that takes place in hell. Somebody murders Lucifer, and then the number two guy in hell, his name's Az. He's trying to figure out who did it, and he's trying to run hell at the same time, and it turns into this big political nightmare. All the souls go on strike. They don't want to work anymore. So it's like a dark comedy, political thriller, murder mystery. But that was my first big book that I started as a webcomic years ago, kind of through this imprint through DC. Didn't really go anywhere. It was just 8 pages at that point. But then I got the right spec, so I decided to self-publish. So I used Kickstarter to raise funds. And that was kind of the beginning of my self-publishing career. Since then, you know, I've done several other small comic books. I have a series called Quick the Clockwork Knight, which is a little robot knight guy who fights monsters, goes on adventures. But that's just kind of like an action adventure series. My most recent book is a return to that character, and it's a choose your own adventure comic book. It's called Quick the Clockwork Knight and the Pyramid of Doom. Again, all this stuff's on my website. I self-publish, so I only really sell at conventions. You know, I'll go around the country a little bit to different comic book shows, and I'll sell stuff that way.
Right.
Or you can also get stuff through my website. But that's what I'm working on. I'm currently working on a sequel to the Choose Your Own Adventure one, because that was very well received. I'm hoping to get a publisher for that. There's been enough interest in that hopefully I'll get a publisher so I can do better distribution with that. But I'm currently working on a similar sequel that's a Choose Your Own Adventure deal.
That's very cool. I'm going to pick that up myself. So, do you continue to use Kickstarter, or was it just that one time that you've used Kickstarter?
No, I've, for everything I've personally published, I've used it for. It's been great for me. Prior to using Kickstarter, what would eventually become my graphic novel Burnt, I was like sending it to publishers and not getting a lot of bites. And another comic book guy I knew from my webcomic days was like, oh, you don't need a publisher. You just go to this thing called Kickstarter and you do it yourself. I was like, what? So I checked it out, and it worked. And I haven't made millions or even close to millions on Kickstarter, but I've made enough that I am making a profit on my comics. Not a big enough profit that I can, you know, quit working for the library. But it is a way to self-publish and like make money self-publishing and not go into debt self-publishing, which was always kind of my fear before I ever did it. I was like, I don't want to self-publish. That seems like a really good way to lose a lot of money.
Right.
And Kickstarter is great because it is worldwide. So, you know, again, I haven't had extreme success from it, but I have built up a pretty consistent following where now when I put a project on Kickstarter, I can expect it to reach a certain threshold because I do have a fan base that's worldwide. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. I did a couple of Kickstarters for this podcast actually, and they went really well. So yeah, but it depends very much on having that base of fans that you can depend on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do encourage anyone who has any sort of creative project, I'm like, give it a go on Kickstarter. I mean, my one big piece of advice is keep low expectations. Don't look at a project that makes $100,000 and think you're going to make $100,000. If you have low expectations, I think Kickstarter is a wonderful place.
Right. Well, and you start low, and if it becomes a $10,000 one, then that's okay. But that wasn't your goal.
Right.
All right, Thane, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about your book and all the various other things we talked about. It is available everywhere you can get ABC Clio materials at conferences or from their site or from Amazon, lots of other places. And I do recommend you do that, especially if you're working with teens. If people want to follow up with you, where could they get in touch with you?
Again, go to my website, ThaneBenson.com. There's a contact form on there. That's an easy way to reach me.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much, Thane.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place or work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at Circ Ideas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas.